Yeah, I still don't hear
Oh man.
it. Does it sound cool on your end?
It sounds so dope.
Okay, sweet. I trust you.
My name's Michael, and the name of the show is Earth 2. And basically, this show is something that we created as an excuse to get together and talk about things that we care about, stuff like just really important stuff like comic books and what have you. Anyway, I'm here with Rebecca Cloonan.
Hello.
You like being called Rebecca?
I do.
It's so official.
It's very professional.
And Winston Conrad, say hello to your fans.
Hello.
You're working in the Gotham universe now.
Oh yes.
Tell me a little, like, we had talked an awful lot about it in the build up to your pitch, and then you pitched it, and then it came to pass, and now it's a real thing with like real cool stuff going on around it. Was there any part of you in the process of getting into the Gotham world that was afraid of the responsibility that you have in contributing to this ongoing mythology of this city, and furthermore of working on a pretty major property for one of the biggest publishing houses in the world? How does that compare to your creation of stuff that's where you own everything and you're writing and drawing everything? Is there a different approach that you take, or is it kind of born out of the same creative muse?
There is definitely, like, my voice, you know, is still apparent, I think. And the structure and the way I tell the story, but it's so different from my mini comics. You know, it's so different from, and it does exist in Gotham. So there's structure that we have to adhere to, and rules we have to follow, characters we can and can't use, and everything has to go by Mark Doyle, the editor, and Carl Kershaw's drawing it. He's just knocking it out of the park. So there's,
well, Mark Doyle is, he's taking some fantastic steps.
Yes,
in
Mark
terms
is great.
Like, he's really, Batman's a huge property. Gotham's a huge property. He's taking it and he's making a whole, it's almost separate from the DCU in terms of some of the choices that he's making. There's some of the books that are coming out almost seem like they could exist anywhere.
Yeah, and he has this idea that he wants to have a Batman comic for everybody. And I think that's so smart because, I mean, we were talking about myths before. I mean, Batman is a modern myth. And if you have, everyone kind of know, it's kind of ingrained in our subconscious right now, the story of Batman and his childhood and the pearls and the roses, you know, and how Batman's origin is kind of permeated our society. And being able to have these stories for everybody, you know, Gotham Academy is, it's all ages, but it's also, you know, we're really thinking about, you know, YA and like the young adult audience and trying to make a book for girls, you know?
I've been so excited by that. You know, I have a niece and a nephew. My brother-in-law is out in Chicago with them, and my nephew is the older of the two, and when he was born after he got to be about 5 or 6 years old, I purchased for him a box set of the collected Tintin comics.
Oh, so good.
You know,
so good.
he really was having trouble getting started reading, and his grandmother is French, and I was like, here is something that the whole family can appreciate. It's a French language boys adventure comic. It's classic. It's really like one of the great stories that's ever been told. And with my niece, who's now getting close to the same age that my nephew was when I gave him the Tintin comics, I found myself at a little bit of a loss, you know? I don't want to give her something that is too girly. I want to encourage the same things that I'm trying to encourage in my nephew, which is a love of the written word, a love of the drawn image, and a sense of adventure and excitement and daring. And you were kind enough to share a PDF version of the upcoming Gotham Academy issue. And I'm so excited.
I want to mention, you had texted me that day being like, I have established a pull list for the first time in my life. the pull list exists solely for Gotham Academy.
My comics reading has been, like, when we were kids, it was very much a rummage bin, like, what can I trade for comics? We didn't have a lot of money growing up and weren't the sort of kids who had allowances.
And you'll find the best shit now.
Yeah, well, like, I was reading graphic novels because there was so much good stuff out there that I hadn't read in first run. So this is the first opportunity where there's a book that I know is coming out that I'm excited about. I'm intending to collect them both so that I can read them personally and for my niece so that she has a book with a female protagonist who's obviously poised for adventure. And I think it's a fantastic thing. You know, something that really can't be found on the market as
yet. Yeah. I don't know. It just felt like the right time and the right thing to do. And I don't know. I was a little worried it was derivative of everything that I love, but then I don't really care because it's just derivative of everything that I love. I mean, mostly we just wanted to make something that's fun. So, you know, that happened, and that was really cool. You mentioned a bit earlier about having to, like, and, you know, we've talked in this about this a few times on this podcast so far, having, you know, growing up in a place where you can't get to a comic book store really easily. There was only one that I knew of, I think that maybe two, like within driving distance. Mm. And then, you know, I really only had a job so I could buy comics, you know, when I actually got working. And because of that, I ended up, you know, I'd have issue, you know, whatever, issue 24 of Silver Surfer, and then I'd end up with issue 26, and then so I'd miss 25, or I'd miss 25 and 26 or whatever, and there'd be all these editor's notes like, see issue 25, and I'd be like, no, I don't want that one. I have to know what happens, like, what happens to Shalabal? How did Phantoms end up on Earth? I don't know. And I wonder if it's that kind of, you know, because he'd be at the grocery store. I'd be with my dad. I'd be like, oh, man, there's another comic. Can we get it? No. You know, and I'd be like, okay, that's fine. You know, we can't get a comic. But having to actually go back and make up what happened between the issues that you missed, or if you just have one or two issues of the comic and you don't have any others, you're constantly wondering, like, what happened to those characters? You know, like, Lorne Rad and Shalabal, in my head, their romance is probably so much more epic than it ever was, like, on paper.
That, without a doubt, has probably inspired more creative thinking than actually reading the books would have done. So I think there's a value to filling in the gaps. But on the same hand, that's a pain that I don't think any of us fully recovered from, is not being able to be the type of comic fan that we wanted to be growing up.
But there's something to be said about having to look for stuff and actually going out and finding it. You know, like you said, like, you go out and you go to these flea markets or whatever, and you score a little bunch of comics, and it's, you know, it feels so good. And now, you know, there's that idea that you could just go anywhere or just go online and type in what you're looking for. Like, I'm looking for Silver Surfer Annual number 1 from 1988. I could just find it. But that's a comic that I actually want to find. So every time I go to a comic book store, I end up looking for it. I don't want to order it. I just want to find it on my own.
Well, and that's, you know, that's one of the things about the artifact of the book itself, that you know, they acquire some power through the circumstances under which you encountered them. There is something sort of totemic about the books, which is part of the reason why, although I will read a book digitally, I'm willing to do so, and in a situation where you want to fill in the gap on a story, now it's increasingly an option to go online and purchase that issue and at least get the story, but the book itself is so precious. And I say that as somebody who gets rid of comics all the time, too. I've moved quite a bit, and I was just talking with my brother not long ago about whether or not a graphic novel that he was reading was one of my...
which we should mention, because it's badass. It's a... fuck, what's it called? Mesmo?
Oh, Mesmo Delivery. Raphael Grappa.
Which you sent me your copy, Becky.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, yeah, I love that comic.
Oh, that one just lit me up, man. That the art in that is out of control.
It's like on Jeff Darrow's level. Intensely detailed and just, you know, it's frenetic. It's kinetic.
So many lines. Hey, digression here. What is he? Does he use technical pens or...
He is a brush guy, and I think he uses a combination of brush and tech pens, I think.
Wow.
Just work. I've been disappointed for years that we haven't seen another one, but I heard recently that he's working on, I saw on his Instagram stream, he was working the character in the cowboy outfit.
He's got a book coming out, or that was supposed to come out a while ago, called Furry Water, and I'm not sure if he's doing that anymore, but that was supposed to be with Dark Horse.
Has there ever been an artist who has captured the imagination of teeming thousands who has only done, like, 3 books?
Raphael Grappa.
He's the guy, right? Well, he's fantastic.
He is fantastic. He's so talented, that guy. He gave me an original of his, and it's like, God, I gotta get it framed. I'm so bad. I just moved too much that I can't, you know, I've got so much art that I need to frame. I need an apartment with a bunch of walls.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you need to have walls before you can frame things.
Yeah. I'm currently between homes, so everyone's like, oh, you're from Montreal. I'm not from Montreal.
I think that gypsy life means that you often have to give up comics. You know, you give them to somebody that you love or somebody who will appreciate them, which is
or just stick
nice
them in your
things.
Mom's basement.
collecting in first run is going to be interesting, though. Like I said, it's a sort of, I see it as almost a kind of luxury that I didn't have previously, but very
exciting. It's fun.
It makes Wednesday a little less shitty.
Yeah. I always like Wednesdays. Even if I don't get to go to a comic shop, I always like the knowing what's coming out, and there's a good feeling about it. It's a feeling of community and camaraderie, and everyone's psyched about everyone else's books. It's kind of cool.
Hey, Becky, do you have any other embarrassing... Not other. I don't think you've said any embarrassing comics that you made when you were a kid.
Spod, some people, one dog, which was awesome. Not embarrassing at all.
Yeah. I was going to say, yeah, that's super embarrassing when you got 2 dudes here being like, I'd read that.
I did Jen Quick and I again. We did a comic. It was called Planet Y, I think our sophomore year in high school. And it was, I think it was our sophomore year. Maybe it was, I can't remember. It might have been before that. Might have been middle school even. It was like, it was like 400 pages long.
Wow.
Yeah, and we did it over the course of a summer. And we we left like dents in the couches that we were sitting on. We just like passed pages back and forth. And by pages, I just mean like computer paper. And it was drawn in pencil. Yeah. And we were keeping all the issues inside a folder. So we do the cover to the issue, which was done in colored pencil. And then
how many pages,
the pages
per issue?
I think it was like between 15 and 20. Like there wasn't like a really set, like we weren't really working to a standard page rate or anything. Because we didn't know those things existed. And I think this was in high school. It was called Planet Y. And it was about, we wanted to call it Planet X, but we were like, it's too much like the X-Men. Like, so we'll have to call it something else. Okay, call it Planet Y. Just the letter Y. And the idea was that there was this evil organization that had taken over everything, and they were trying to genetically create the strongest monster in the universe. And so then they had all these scrap monsters that they had just made genetically that were like, this one's not the strongest. And they just started putting them on this planet called Planet Y. Because they had, it was like, yeah,
Hold
it was
on.
This.
This is another fantastic idea.
Wait, you haven't heard the best part.
No one cares about this idea anymore. I'm talking about a pilot that got molested. No one wants that. You got a planet full of misshapen freaks?
Yeah.
I'm
genetically engineered monsters, yeah. I mean,
I want a planet Y ongoing. Anyway,
So here's the overall concept, right? This is a planet full of monsters. Monster planet, Planet Y. And it's owned by this company, an evil organization. I don't remember the company's name. I don't think it was important. Anyway, they decided to set up. They're like, well, we've got this planet full of monsters. What do we do with it? And they're like, let's start. And because gladiators are illegal at this point in the future. So they had an illegal gladiator tournament on Planet
what
Y.
What the fuck?
So they had recruited gladiators. From all over the universe.
It was a kumite. It was a blood sport.
there was a werewolf gladiator, and there was a gladiator who used to be a chef, and there was his name was Drake.
Becky, this is the type of thing where if I came up with this idea, I'm 35 fucking years old. If I came up with this idea, I would text you with a lot of exclamation points, being like, "I got the one."
This
I got
it.
The one.
This is the one.
Oh, my Lord.
Well, you know, and it was three girls and two guys, and they were on this planet fighting monsters. And, okay, in 400 pages, how many gladiator fights do you think there were?
Probably 15.
No, two and a half.
Oh,
two and
amazing.
Whoa.
They Word. Spent the entire time, like, they had... They had parties, they went out to eat, they...
Relationship issues.
Relationship drama, they played chess, they worked out, they had treadmills that they would run on. There was all these things that they could do, and it took them...
I think with
it was like Star Trek.
Editing, you could get it down to none. And I think that would be the best book ever, is one that pitches, you pitch it on endless gladiator fights between mutant freaks, and then what you give them is... conversations over pizza.
Yeah, that's all it was.
The best X-Men shit were Chris Claremont writing the baseball games.
Oh yeah, or the when they
like
the
days off, the pool parties, the chilling
basketball when you remember that one when all the girls went to the mall and they who had a makeover? I can't remember who it was. They all the ladies went to the mall and like gave Jubilee a makeover or something.
Jubilee doesn't.
It's like the greatest.
She...
I don't remember if it was Jubilee, but it was Jubilee. It was Psylocke was still, or it was Betsy Braddock was still around before Psylocke.
Wow.
Before she switched bodies with the Japanese assassin.
I had the biggest crush on Psylocke growing up. I can't lie.
Who did not? Let me tell you.
Yeah, I know. That will turn ahead when you got a purple-haired British Asian girl.
Yeah, and I was always like, because, okay, so Psylocke's thing is that she switched bodies with this assassin that was trying to kill her, and I think the Phoenix was like partly responsible for that. Like she's got some of the Phoenix. Psylocke does, or think. And I could be wrong about that whole thing because it's been a long time since I've read these books.
That would be even better. I would like it best when people don't quite remember.
Yes, this is how my fuzzy memory of Psylocke.
That's what you wanted to happen.
That's what I wanted. I wanted her to have the Phoenix power. But I always thought if I was going to do a Psylocke comic, I would do it completely about women's body issues, because she's got to have some disassociative body issues. If she used to be a British chick, now she's Japanese, and she's like a super hot assassin chick, how much of that is like muscle memory? How does she feel when she looks, because she used to be a model, right? Uh-huh. Betsy Braddock was the supermodel. How does she feel if she looks and like sees an old commercial of like a Pantene Pro-V commercial of herself? Like, does she think that's me? And now does she associate herself with being Asian now? Is there like, what is her racial identity? What is her, like, does she wear that thong because she actually doesn't feel like it's her body? Like, is she like, oh, I could just wear whatever because I'm not, this isn't me. You know, how much of, and how healthy is that?
Yeah, have you ever pitched that?
I think I've talked about it, and everyone's like, oh, that's cool, for like a two-issue one-shot.
Shut up.
But I don't know, maybe one day. I don't know, I've got a few.
Wow.
I wonder if that's just too much for an X-Men comic, though.
No, it's not. It's what they need.
Spoken. There you go.
Make
it so.
Here's the thing about comics. Like we were talking about Gotham Academy and how it's like written for all ages and this and that, and it's super cool that there's actually a female protagonist who's got her own sense of agency, and I don't give a shit. I'm a 35-year-old man, and that's the comic I want to read. Like, I don't care about all the rest of the baggage that's attached to these comics. Yes, I want to read about ass-kicking dudes as much as I want to read about a not-ass-kicking tweener who's just investigating. You know, like, a good story is a good story. So anyone that thinks that there isn't room for a Psylocke body issue story... Like, that's the shit I want to read. Like,
that would be all the stuff that would be, you know, that's the theme of the comic. I always end up, you know, I wonder if I think about theme too much, but that would be the core of it. And then you'd have ass kicking and all the other stuff that would go along with that, of course. But then
she's got her psionic knife. She's going to stick you in the brain piece.
Well, I think it's very important for this story is that the non-action segments are in many ways more important than the action segments. If we think about what was effective about a movie like Jaws, it's that most of the time you don't see the shark. Most of the time you don't really see what happens. And so... If you have a comic where it's all action all the time, and even when it's not action, the characters seem very active, and it's all in reference to action, then the action itself becomes less impactful. If, on the other hand, people are spending time trying to, handle their taxes and have a decent relationship with another human being, and then all of a sudden there's action, that action becomes meaningful. That action becomes... reflective of our real lives, where things happen suddenly and unexpectedly and in a terrifying way. You know, I mean.
So a lot like Planet Y.
It is an awful lot like Planet. One thing about Planet Y that I do know, and granted, I never read the 400-page manifesto, is that it captures all that involve, like all the stresses of adulthood. Basically balled up. Planet Y, if you could dig that up, like, I'm not a man of wealth, but I will publish the entire 400 pages. There might only be one copy, and it might just live in my home. And you might, like, maybe I'll offer a thing where if you fly to my home, you can read Planet Y by Becky Cloonan.
No photos, please.
No, there will be photos. There's
it's
a
like
photo
it's
box.
Like the it's like the Vatican. You can't take pictures.
Planet Y is so leaps and bounds ahead of what I was doing at the time. I think that so my progression was I pretty much went from I talked about how I didn't have access to comics as a young man, but there was a weird moment where Marvel offered subscription opportunities for, like, the more you get, the cheaper they get kind of thing. And I got a subscription to Punisher. And, yeah. into Punisher War Journal, which at the time
was... the Jim Lee ones?
Yeah, when he went to Hawaii.
Oh, so good. Those were incredible.
The best fucking thing in the world.
Seriously.
Punisher War Journal. Punisher in his regular comic was fighting Jigsaw, who was a big time favorite at the time. He was like a cartel guy who got his face cut up and then stitched back together so it looked like a Jigsaw puzzle of a face. And at the time, the X titles, which I subscribed to New Mutants, as done by the great Rob Liefeld, which became X-Force, and they were sweet enough to change it from a New Mutants subscription to an X-Force subscription, which I appreciated.
Mm, that's cool.
X-Force, X-Factor, X-Men, Uncanny X-Men. I had so many subscriptions, it was really sweet.
I didn't have any. How did I not know about this?
I don't know. I found it in the back of a Marvel comic, and my mom, like I said, I pretty much begged her, and she got them for me.
That's
and
cool.
And it was a big-time turning point. And from that turning point, it was around that time that I started working, so I was generating a paycheck, and every now and then I could get to the comic store, which...
That's actually what it was called.
Yeah, that's the fancy name that they came up for. It was
the comic store.
And was that the one on Main Street in Nashville?
Yeah, yes. There was two. There was one on Main Street, and there was one. Is that Amherst Road?
I never
went. It was the one. It was like near that. It was a Market Basket and a CVS and a Chinese restaurant called the Mandarin. That was right next door.
You know the whole lay of the land?
Like, I do. I remember that very clearly.
That was your stomping grounds for a second.
Heck yeah.
Yeah, so the comic store, which if you looked it up in the yellow pages for a small town, it was comic store, comma, the.
The. It was the only one.
Which I really appreciated.
Did you guys ever go to Newberry Comics?
I did. It was, by the time that I started frequenting there, it was much less a comic place and more of like a, it was where I was buying like a lot of punk CDs and vinyl and like no, they had a really good vinyl selection. I was getting like a lot of black metal vinyl that you can find elsewhere. And not really.
In the last 5 or 6 years?
Have I what?
Have you been recently?
Oh, no, I haven't been since I lived in Boston, which was, at this point, quite a while ago. Mm. I don't even, if they still carry comics, I would be shocked.
They still have a small section. I was just, the change in the store is, you know, it is what it is, but the whole neighborhood is totally different now. It's crazy.
I would like to revisit that. That was a place that I discovered a lot of things that I liked.
It's super shishy now. It's like all high-end stores.
Sounds pretty lame. Sounds like right up my alley. So anyway, I had these subscriptions, and from that, I got jobs. And from that... This was around when Image first came to be. So Jim Lee, Rob Liefeld, Todd McFarlane, Eric Larson, the whole gang, Jim Valentino, everyone that was like part of the original seven Image guys, I was aware of their previous work, and I was stoked on them going and doing their own thing. So I got into Image and Valiant stuff because they were doing crossovers and they were the Young Gunners, and that was when I first started to care about creators' rights and things like that, because they put that on Front Street. They were very big about how everything that they had done for the big two they didn't necessarily own, and here they were, and here's their stuff that is straight from their heart. So I got very excited about it, and I got very charged up by it. And as a result, probably mostly through Todd McFarlane, I got into Dave Sim doing Cerebus and Neil Gaiman had already been in my paradigm because for whatever reason I started picking up Sandman from issue one in the floppies, which I still like. I wave that flag as a banner of pride in my comics reading experience because it's hard to find somebody who hasn't been touched by Sandman. And I read it start to finish in floppies. I also owned all the trades, and all of those things ended up in a box in my dad's basement, and I think that my little brother has adopted all of them, and I'm trying to find a way to let him know that I would love to get those back.
Maybe he could just listen to this.
Yeah, if you listen to this...
Steven, give me back my comics.
Steven, I would love this. I would love that Sandman shit. And my Preacher trades, please. Those are the things I want back.
I borrowed those from him. He very kindly lent those to me.
That's great. That's great. All the brothers should read these things. But
I gave him an enormous number of trades. I gave him most of Transmetropolitan.
Oh, that was fun. That was a fun book.
I love that book so much.
What it boils down to is I went from Image to Vertigo stuff almost overnight. There was no real transition. I just felt like, hey, I'm a grown-up now. It's time for me to read Vertigo. It's time for me to lay down these other things. I've since found a happy medium of I love all comics to varying degrees. But I thought that I was super grown up, so my early homemade comics changed dramatically from a character like Gamble, who you might have picked up, might be a little bit of a nod to Gambit. I don't know why one might make that jump. But it went from that to Sandman ripoff after Sandman ripoff. I love the way that the Sandman comic allowed so much room for storytelling and how he pretty much existed throughout time and space and was able to communicate a number of different narrative motifs.
There have been a bunch of characters that have accomplished that, right? Like Doctor Strange is a great character for that, or Silver Surfer,
Absolutely.
You look at this, it's like Silver Surfer, that's a philosopher. I mean, he was always really thinking, really, really very tragic, I guess, human life. Was he human, even?
He's human enough.
Yeah.
He's humanoid, but...
Yeah. Before he turned into the Silver Surfer, he was Norrin Rad.
Norrin Rad.
Yeah, struggling with his love, Shalabal. But there's that tragic, you know, and that's myth again, you know, and he's always struggling with, he doesn't want to destroy planets, and here he's got to find planets to destroy for Galactus, that Galactus can eat.
Is that, Silver Surfer is such a cool character.
I know.
Ended up being a character like that too, right? I mean, that's, a couple of the characters just managed to break all boundaries and inhabit like a cosmic paradigm.
Yeah, and it's literary too, you know? It's like...
Yeah.
I think when you get into that, you're able to put a little bit more poetry into the work. And it's a little bit harder to do. I mean, with Gotham Academy, there's a lot of nods. I mean, we have a character reading Tennyson, and I put Cicero, a bust of Cicero, on the cover to issue two. So there's a lot of fun stuff. Like, there's a Mr. Darcy poster.
You got that badass vibe.
Yeah, Mr. Darcy poster in one of the rooms.
How do you say Carl's last name?
Kershaw.
His cover to, is it issue three?
Issue three, yeah. when it's like an overhead shot of the detention and the desks and she's drawing.
Shit.
Oh, it's so good. Carl is phenomenal.
That is hands down one of the coolest images I've seen. Like, just the everything from the technical draftsmanship of it, like the angle and perspective is, you know, you can't mess with that. But I don't know, there's something about that particular cover that spoke to me and made me nostalgic in a way that I don't normally get.
Yeah, for detention.
Yeah, right?
There's such a nice gothic vibe throughout, too. I mean, that's fans of Poe and Lovecraft. And it's just a delicious visual motif.
You know, Winston and I went to the 2014 Image Expo that was in San Francisco.
Like, January.
Yeah, not the one that you did in San Diego, which... Yeah.
Went to the first one that they had.
Yeah, it still really pisses me off that they didn't have the one for Southern Cross in San Francisco. That would have been just...
But let me tell you, that was... Eric Stevenson is kind of a mastermind, I think, because... He had the Image Expo held at San Diego. I mean, he could have done it in San Francisco. We were talking about, you know, I was trying to figure out logistics, like how would I fly up to San Francisco before San Diego and then fly down? I mean, that's not really too difficult. But
I wish he had.
But here's what he did. He had it at like the Hilton or whatever at San Diego on the Wednesday.
It was like the day before San Diego kicked off?
Is San Diego, I think, there's a creator night or something, or a professional night on Wednesday, or maybe Thursday's pro day. I can't even remember. Yeah, the convention's 4 days long. It's Thursday to Sunday, and then Wednesday's, like, pros only.
It's getting too goddamn much.
Yeah, and there's no, there's no releases on Wednesday. No one's really announcing anything or releasing anything. So what Eric did is he monopolized all of the comic book news coming out of San Diego for one whole day on Wednesday by doing that Image Expo there at Comic-Con. So it was very smart of him to do. Yeah. Well, and it was cool to announce a book at that.
I can only speak selfishly and be like, I would have loved to have seen you and Andy present on stage.
We were only up there for like a minute, maybe 2 minutes.
Yeah, I heard that. I heard that the San Diego Image Expo was much shorter than is typical. Which again, I feel like put it here in old SF, and let us just really relish what's going on here.
I want to go back to San Francisco. It's been a while since I've been there.
Well, I mean, your travels take you.
In near and far.
Different directions. it's only a matter of time.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I'm really excited for Southern Cross. I think it's going to be...
That's cool.
Going to be a banger of a book. Which is kind of like a strange return to form for you in terms of you're telling another epic story, creator-owned, this and that. But it's almost in the opposite type of environment that we're used to seeing Becky Cloonan create her own stuff going on. You know, like we're used to swords and strange romance and sadness.
There's still going to be sadness in Southern Cross.
Okay, there's still sadness.
And Gotham Academy. I mean, it walks that line of gothic romance. I think.
Southern Cross is going to be like the strange out of nowhere book from you, I think.
It is. It's going to be crazy. And Andy Belanger is doing art on it. And if I was drawing this myself.
I've been checking his Tumblr and
it's crazy.
He's working his balls off on it.
Yeah.
It's going to be so crazy.
Yeah. And when I write Southern Cross for him, he has more of a sense of humor, I think, in his art than I do. I think my art gets a bit serious and kind of weighed down sometimes. And Andy doesn't really have that in his work. So I constantly have to think about, like, you know, the funny moments that Andy's going to put in to the work. So when I'm writing for him, it's like, you know, I've really got to put my head in a different spot than where it is if I'm just writing for myself.
Well, in terms of the overall mood of Southern Cross, do you expect it to be as heavy as some of your self-published stuff, or is it what's the approach on that? Because Gotham Academy seems to be pretty it's less
fun.
Heavy than
It touches on heavy things, but it's mostly fun. You know, I mean, it's about growing up, and growing up is difficult, so it has that. And then it's growing up in Gotham, which is even more difficult. But overall, we want the tone of the story to be fun. It's about friends. It's about mysteries and ghosts and stuff. And
Southern Cross is about a girl in space.
Yeah.
Going to find her dead sister or something?
Yeah. Yeah, her sister. She has a twin sister.
And, so where's the comedy come in with the dead sister?
Well, yeah, I know. That's this is the story. It starts out as a murder mystery. It's like who?
Don't give too much away.
No, you're not.
Leave
mad.
Me. Leave one.
I will. I'm not going to tell everyone. I'm not going to spoil it. Basically, right. You know, she's on this trip to kind of recover her sister's effects and her remains from the oil. The moon Titan, which is now an oil refinery moon. So she's gone up to kind of collect her sister's effects. She worked for this company called Zemi, which is a big oil company, and it's kind of in the future, but we're still kind of in the solar system. Okay. A lot of it comes in the side characters, a lot of the comedy.
I'm so looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Again, if you want to see some
preview art, some crazy preview art
of what's
art.
Going on. Yeah, look up Andy Belanger on Tumblr.
And he's
Tumblr.
Just gone crazy with it. He's like, okay, so there's this pop star in the future called Dion, who's like David Bowie in space, and I'm like, I'm there, I'm right there. So he has all this stuff. I was like, Dion's not even in the comic, you know? He might be referenced or something, but he's not really, or there might be a poster of him somewhere in someone's locker. But he's gone so far into the world building of this. It's like, I feel like sometimes I have to pull him back and be like, no, well, there's work on the pages.
But that's
you have a whole script. It's great because he's.
If you want, like, the director's cut of this stuff as it goes on, look him up on, like, Tumblr or Instagram or whatever social network works best for you.
Yeah.
Look him up. Look up Becky. You've provided some indication through various means of what to expect from that book, and I think it's going to be really cool. And while it doesn't tie into the core subject of publishing, Image really is a company that is about as close to self-publishing as you can get with major distribution. Am I right here?
Yeah. It's kind of a step between self-publishing and, you know, working for a larger publisher. And I think some of that's just the fact that, you know, you own more of the property than you would if you worked for any other publisher, or comic book publisher anyway. It's sort of a weird time, I mean, right? Like, so many comics get made into films, and that's kind of where your big paycheck is, and that's kind of what everyone is hoping for in the back of their minds. It's like, oh, when this becomes a film, I will get, that's my payday. Because you're really not making too much off the books. You might, you know, catch a break and someone on NPR will do, you know, a piece on it and then everyone's going to buy the book. But, you know, until then, you're not really looking at much in royalties and you're not looking at much on, like, a monthly basis. So I think this idea of getting a movie, getting an option even, just having someone buy it out completely, is like the holy grail right now, and I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing. Because now a lot of publishers will want to take a cut of your media rights. And I think when you step back and look at publishing as a whole, you know, a lot of book publishers aren't going to do this. You know, book publishers don't take your media rights. It's really mostly a phenomenon in comics, and I think it creates this false hope, and as a creator, you're almost forced into giving up some of these rights that I don't necessarily think you should have to give up.
Yeah.
And it's, but there's not really another choice. It's like, what, you know, what other choice do you have besides self-publishing? And then you look at my mini comics. Who the hell is going to make a film out of those? Like, those are unsellable yeah. as films. They're not going to. They're made to be read as comics. And if someone looks at it and calls me up and is like, "Hey, I want to make a movie based on these," I'll basically be like, "Well, this person's crazy. You know, well, why would I want to work with a crazy person?"
It would be one of those cool movies. You know, it would be yeah. a cool. It would be a cool movie.
Maybe a short film, but just not. No, it's just, they're too weird. You know.
I think that there's so many different comics properties that, like, we're hitting the tip of the spear right now in terms of, like, Avengers performed really well, Captain America did really well, Guardians of the Galaxy even did really well. I think it's only a matter of time before you see, like, that Chester Brown movie that we've all been waiting for. Where he,
paying for it?
Yeah, where he does do the Chester. I'm looking forward to. I mean, we've already had a taste of it with Ghost World was a movie.
Yeah.
And I thought it was cool. You know, or there's even movies that we don't even necessarily. And when I say we, I mean like the film fan public, like. A lot of people don't recognize that History of Violence or Road to Perdition were comics properties, or Red is a comic property, or The Losers, or
yeah.
there's a number of different...
Blade, even?
Yeah, Blade. Blade was like the first Marvel movie to do something so in the box great. Office. And here they might be bringing Blade back.
Yes.
Beyond that, yeah, there's a Pixar movie coming out called Big Hero 6 or something of that nature that's based on a very small Marvel Comics property that wasn't necessarily a huge affair when it came out, but this Pixar movie is going to do big numbers. I guarantee it. Marvel has not said that they're going to do anything with those comics. But it's going to do big numbers. So I think that we're going to find more and more of our favorite creators are being harvested. So I would encourage you, Becky, as somebody who's in the mix, to not necessarily rule out that proposition. Because if I get a Wolves film, I don't even care how bad it is. I'll be like, oh, that's kind of cool to see people running around pretending to do this comic that I love so much.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that it wouldn't be, you know, I would not be into it if someone came to me with a serious proposition. But it's one of those things where I'm going into it knowing full well if, you know, and I have, a few people have approached me about doing Wolves and or some of my mini comics, and I'm always, you take it with a grain of salt. It's
you got
like you can't.
Wolves,
the Mire and Demeter.
Mire.
Yep. But
Eisner Award winning and stuff, so that's...
Yeah, cool. Oh, I just won a British Fantasy Award for Demeter, too. That was
cool. My word, I saw pictures of just how the award looks.
It's like a bookend, I love it.
It's very...
Now I need a house. So I can get some shelves.
Yeah,
so
put some shelving units
on it. Yeah.
Get some shitty IKEA shelving unit.
And I like the IKEA shelves. Those big screws.
Oh, you don't love those.
I do. They're room dividers. Let me tell you, when I was up in Montreal, I made a wall of books, and it was with those IKEA shelves. I put books on both sides of them and created this giant wall so no one could come into my space without, like, knocking on my bookshelf.
No one named Julian can come
in. Nobody.
What up, Julian? How you doing, boo? So, did you have any embarrassing early comic stories?
That, well, I told you my embarrassing comics.
But they were legitimate comic stories.
They were legitimate comic stories, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I've always done like 100%.
Do you have any early comics creations that you want to share that might incite some laughter from the kids?
You know, I didn't attempt to make a comic. My early drawing was drawings of the Greek myths, drawings of Dungeons and Dragons characters, and then later I got into printmaking and painting, and have always incorporated text in the imagery that I've produced, but it's been largely non-representational, done some representational work, but always been interested in words and pictures together. I produced a 23-page comic couple of years back, but was disappointed when the plot line that I had written was used in a South Park episode in a very different way, but close enough that it just bummed me out.
That's always a bummer.
Yeah, there's a comic coming out that Becky sold me out on. She
gave me your idea.
Did an alternate cover for this comic called The Witches that I'm so excited about. I think it's going to be the best shit. It's Scott Snyder, who I adore, and Jock, who proved himself to be really just one of the sweetest people that I've met in the comics industry.
Jock is a sweetheart. He's actually coming to Austin next week, so we're going to have some sweet hangs.
No way. So you're gonna smell him and stuff?
Oh, Jock, let me tell you, you haven't smelled Jock yet. He is the greatest smelling cartoonist I've ever met.
What does he wear?
I don't know. I think I probably have asked him, but I think he was drunk and just forgot what it was. But I was thinking that we could bottle it.
We asked him in
Seattle.
Seattle, yeah, exactly. But yeah, too much had been drunk at that point.
Yeah.
You know what? We were all in Seattle at Emerald City.
Oh, that was a fun show.
Winston and I went up to Trip the Night Fantastique with Becky, and Jock was critical in finding a bar that didn't have so many people in it. He found this weird little basement bar.
That was a more steakhouse, actually.
Oh yeah, that was good.
Yeah, that was the bar at the Morton Steakhouse was fantastic. Very civilized.
Morton's. Yeah, in the basement.
Which it was just a really important place to be at the time, because we were all feeling maybe a little overwhelmed.
Yeah. Emerald City can happen at conventions.
Emerald City is a big show. Mm-hmm. Becky had been at her all day, and I think we caught up with her at the end of the day. Winston and I were just trolling around, just checking out.
Just trolling, you know? Just
checking shit out, and we caught up with Becky at the end, and she was just being absolutely bombarded by people who, and she was sweet. She was like, hey, like, this is really cool that you're into what I've created. But I'm just tired. Now I'm tired.
And I need a drink.
Yeah. And we tried a couple different places, and then Jock hit up Becky or Winston and was like, hey, I found the spot. We went to it, and it was perfectly conducive to having just like, hey, let's unwind a little bit.
Yeah.
And chill out. And then
that's really hard to find, too, like at a convention.
Yeah,
you know, to finding a quiet bar where there's not too many people, where you can kind of just go and I find conventions a little bit difficult, just in the fact that you have to interact with so many people that you don't know, and people that you do know that you might just have forgotten their name or might have only met once or twice, and then having to engage everybody on like an individual level, I find is like kind of mentally taxing.
Well, that's quiet spot lasted for about an hour and a half, and then then we hooked up with Snyder and James Tynion, and I think it was Ben McCool who found this great spot that we should walk 5 miles to. And when we walked 5 miles to it, we entered into a spot that was a fog machine cloud with a well-endowed African-American man dancing on stage in a Speedo.
Was it a Batman Speedo?
There was a Batman logo on
it. I remember that. That was a place called Neighbors, I think. That was a gay bar.
That was all cool.
It was all cool.
There was no issue with it.
There was no alcohol. Unacceptable.
It was a dry bar.
Yeah.
It's just that Seattle turns out to be terribly uncivilized and stops serving alcohol at like 1 a.m. or something ungodly like that. It's unthinkable. And then you walk around town, and it is impossible to buy a booze after 1 a.m. It's ridiculous.
But
yeah. Like the Stone Ages.
But then editor at large Will Dennis showed up, and he had a little sampler in his back pocket, and we were able to hang out in the lobby of whatever was it the Sheridan or something.
Yeah, it might have been. Those are good times.
Either way, it was a classic night full of classic moments. But the thing that feeling was when
Jock's really good.
He's just a little bit cooler than everyone else.
Jock is amazing.
He was drinking. He was drinking Stella out of strange glasses. He's like, yeah, that's what you drink Stella out of, man.
Yeah, the fancy glasses.
The tempest accent. I was like, man, you're all class. And then the morning, Winston and I. We had no responsibilities there, so we were like, hey, let's go check on all these people that we hung out with last night and see who needs what. So we hit up Becky's table. She's like, I'm fine. I've got this water. I'm trying. I'm doing what I can. And then promptly her fan base shoved us out of the way, and we're like, fine, fuck y'all, man. We went to see Yannick and Jock. And Jock was commission piece. He was painting, like, in people's faces. And he smelled good. He looked good.
How are you?
And I offered him food and drink, and he was just like, no, I'm fine, man. I'm good. It really aggravated the shit out of me. I hate when people are super talented and seemingly unaffected by life itself.
Yeah, and he smells really good. I always thought if we could bottle that and then market it, he could do a little drawing on it.
Just call it like Eau de Jacques. I'm not entirely convinced that he wears a fragrance. I think
it's just his musk.
That's just what he sweats out, something that smells like cool water.
Yeah. I could talk about how great Jock smells for another hour at least.
No, without a doubt. But we've got more embarrassing comics to talk about. Yeah, I think I'm out of embarrassing comics. I'm sure there's more. I did my share of like Fantastic Four knockoffs, X-Men knockoffs. Superman knockoff.
Gamble takes the cake, though.
Gamble's pretty good.
Gamble's the one.
And that's the name of this episode.
Gamble
takes the cake.
Yeah. Gamble's got to race me to that cake. I'm a big boy. I like cake. I bet a sweet tooth. Have you guys had sweet tooths lately?
I've actually lost my sweet tooth.
I never had one in my life, and lately I've been like looking at donuts and shit.
That's the onset of the beatus. I'm pretty sure that's...
I'm going to end up with the beatus.
You're going to end up with the beatus.
That's
an early warning signal, you know?
I don't want the beatus.
Hey, let me...
I can't feel my feet. Is that a thing?
That's also a sign of the beat.
That's too much cocaine, I think.
It's that cane. I gotta quit doing that cane. I can't feel my feet.
I have an embarrassing cartoon obsession, which is an obsession with Thundar the Barbarian.
Thundar?
Who is himself a kind of a knockoffy character, you know what I mean? He's a kind of Conan the Barbarian, except mixed with some Luke Skywalker. Fantastic, like Hanna-Barbera-ish cartoon. I saw Thundar on Hanna-Barbera World of Super Adventure.
Hold on. There's nothing wrong with Hanna-Barbera World of Super Adventure.
No, I love the limited animation, early cell animation. That stuff's just awesome.
I don't want to go down as this being a cast that does not support Hanna-Barbera. I'm a Hanna-Barbera man.
No, I mean, Hanna-Barbera, come on. The Fantastic Four is awesome. And they show so few of the Fantastic Four episodes on Hanna-Barbera World of Super Adventure. I'd stay up. You know, I'd get up early just to see that show before I went to school. And yeah. I would hope that it would be a Fantastic Four episode, and it almost never was. It was often Herculoids, which is awesome.
Herculoids. You were way more into animation than I was as a kid. And because I preferred, like, Lassie and Dennis the Menace on Nick at Night, which would play into the morning. And you would force upon me the Hanna-Barbera World of Super Adventure. So I think between that and the Greek mythology love, that's like a big part of why I care about comics. And when you care about comics, the next step is caring about sequential art, period. So I thank you thoroughly for giving me the thing that... you know, as a grown man, it's allowed me to reconnect to my childhood and also to escape from just the boredom of not being into that shit. So, good on you.
Some of that early animation is great anyhow. I loved the Hobbit movie, you know.
Oh man. So good. Those songs were so good.
What was the name of the guy who did the... remember the Lord of the Rings?
Ralph Bakshi.
Rotoscoped
sections there with the guys in costume. That's just so nicely done.
Yeah, I had him as a teacher.
You're also responsible for me getting into like Quentin Tarantino and David Lynch. I remember watching on the late night watching Eraserhead with you, and you being like, "Yeah, this is my shit, man. This is what I'm into now. This is who I am now." And me being like, "What the fuck are you, man?"
Well, you know, I think
this seems to be about abortion, boo.
But just like the limited animation stuff, I really love things that are a little bit coarse, things that are a little roughly produced. It's just something really delicious, and Quentin Tarantino's work captures some of that, his love of exploitation cinema, exploitation style, or kung fu style, low budget productions. There's something very nice about, and I think anybody who makes pictures, you know, you get an appreciation for something that's clean and clear and new looking, and you have another kind of appreciation for something that's faded and worn. And you know, I think the texture of things is very exciting. I saw recently a great movie that I wanted to recommend, which is The Zero Theorem.
I haven't watched it yet because it's $10 to rent, man.
It's $10. Worth every dollar.
I love Terry Gilliam. You know this, and it's because of you that I love Terry Gilliam. Because
12 Monkeys in Brazil, 12 was that?
Brazil, exactly. You know who I'm talking about. 12 Monkeys, Brazil.
Dude, Time Bandits, Baron come von on.
Munchausen. Yeah, Time Bandits. Baron Munchausen.
Well. Yes, and even his later work where his budget suffered, and as a result, everything else kind of suffered. But I thought Tideland was pretty fucking good, even though, the budget didn't allow for the kind of graphics that you wanted. But yeah, tell us about Zero Theorem and about specifically the thing that interests me most, of course, is the portion that I unintentionally plagiarized.
Well, this has been
the story of my creative life recently, by the by. Every fucking idea that I come up with has either already done or will be done by someone who's got greater recognition and talent than me.
Well, but this is just an experience of the world. You know, like in Ecclesiastes, which is a book in the Old Testament, it's probably about 8,000 or 9,000 years old. It says nothing is new under the sun, and that was true then as it is now. You know, there's no way to come up with an original idea. Anything that you think of has already been done and is being done and will be done and so forth. And like originality is one of those things that just like.
And it's all in how you tell the story anyway, you know, because people are gonna you have a completely different experience and voice than anyone else. So I always feel like if you're conscious about it, scrap it and come back to it later.
So, but there was an image though that I thought was compellingly similar to an image in a short comic that you had done that I just posted on your website, and in it there was a nude, hairless figure in a fetal position hurtling through the void of space. And as it happens in Zero Theorem, there is indeed a scene where a nude, hairless man in a fetal position hurtles through the void of space. And it's part of a whole set of philosophical themes that are probably common between the two stories, which is how I think both of you ended up with the same image. But as with a lot of Terry Gilliam's work, it's quite surrealistic and has a subtext.
You said that this was one of the best movies you've seen in a very long time.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. I mean, it's visually compelling, and as I say, it does attempt to grapple with some very basic existential and ontological problems, and I think that's awesome in film. You know?
I didn't even know it was out yet because I live in a cave.
Yeah,
it may yet be in theaters. I'm not sure, but that I'm sure is part of why it has an exorbitant digital rental price. But I'll tell you, it's worth the money. I highly recommend it.
You know, a movie I watched the other night that I loved. Have you guys seen the Dallas Buyers Club yet? I know I'm like a year late on this.
I haven't seen it either because I live in a cave.
I got it out of the Redbox thing that they have at like Safeway or wherever you're at. I'm sure they got it.
Brought to you by Redbox and Safeway.
Yeah, brought to you by Red. we'll accept payment. But yeah, that's Matthew McConaughey. Jared Leto, some great actors. Jared Leto plays a transvestite in it and is so compelling and beautiful and awesome in that role. That alone is worth watching it for, but for people that fancy themselves writers, I say watch this film to learn about how to sidestep exposition. There's so much stuff in this movie that could have used an additional scene for setup where they have, whoever created these choices understood that if you are going into a scene expecting something to happen that you can pretty much count on it happening and thus you don't need to show that shit. So the pacing of this movie is
fantastic. It's really exceptional. And it's about a subject that that's meaningful, you know? The AIDS crisis of our youth didn't just go away. There's still a need there, and there's and it's easily transposed to other medical crises that we're kind of currently living in. So I definitely think that this movie isn't like a straight indictment of big pharma companies, but it does a pretty good job of exposing the inequities of our Medicare system that we're currently living in. So go out and pick that up. Get it from the Redbox or some, or rent it on. I looked on a number of places where I could rent it online, and it was only available for purchase. So try and find a way to watch it, and do watch it, and just really enjoy it for what it is, but also hopefully it'll take some of the message of that film to heart. And yeah, really cool movie. That's my kind of the thing I'm into. That, and I've been watching anime like a motherfucker, which we'll save for maybe a future episode. Becky's got a wealth of information on that.
Oh yeah.
Because anime has kind of been my thing lately. And I don't know why. I think because I like looking at the art and watching a movie at the same time. It's like reading a comic book on a movie. I don't know.
Do you like it subtitled or dubbed better? Or maybe that's a question we should wait until...
I don't want to bury the lead on that one. Subtitled is preferential in some ways, but dubbed is better for if you're drawing at the time.
Yeah, agreed. So much of that is dependent on if you're drawing at the time.
If you're drawing at the time, you need to be able to check out in certain visual ways.
Yeah.
Becky, it was good talking with you.
Yeah, it's good talking to you too.
Winston, good talking with you, bud.